This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, Pete? Welcome back to Rebounding Safety. Today is the last episode, the delayed slash late last episode of the quarterly co-host. Let's jump into the intro and we'll talk some more about it. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution or one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent.
What's up, Pete? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast that's attempting to do exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button, like button, follow button, whatever it is on the platform that you are listening slash watching on. My name is James McPherson. I'm your host for today. I'm also the lead consultant, MD and founder and all fucking fancy titles that we put on shit nowadays of Risk Fluent, which is the health, safety and culture and fire consultancy that sits behind Rebranding Safety. So if you need help with that stuff, go and check it out. So we're late. I apologize. We are so freaking busy. I'm going to do another diary episode after recording this intro. I've had to record this intro on my to-do list for an embarrassingly long time. I tried to do it on my phone as we went and it cut off and it didn't work. And then I just kept forgetting. And you don't care. You just want content. And we have built that rod for our own back. And you deserve that content. But at the moment, we're slipping a little bit. So slight apology for this to be late. The next apology is we don't actually have a quarterly co-host for the next quarter, so we're going to pause it for a little bit because it's surprisingly hard to find somebody that wants to do it. It's hard. It's a lot of work actually to try and get guests on the podcast, and particularly with people that are going to do three episodes, and it's a lot of work. So quarterly co-host paused for now. Hopefully got some value out of the ones we had. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing them. For those that we've had, thank you for everyone that's done a quarterly co-host. I'm kind of glad we're finishing on Tom because it's one of my favorites. But without further ado, let's jump into the last ever, well, not ever, but the last for now quarterly co-host and the last quarterly co-host episode with the amazing Tom Geraghty.
Tom, welcome back to the podcast. Last time you breathe a sigh of relief.
Oh no, it's good to be here. I'm looking forward to this one. I've really enjoyed the past two, and I think this is gonna be a culmination of all
I've had quite a lot of people say I've listened to it, it's been really good and really enjoyed it and got a lot from it. So thank you very much for coming on and for staying on for three episodes, surviving three episodes. So we're going to start off for a short period of time, kind of talk about the relationship with psychological safety and workers don't work to imagine. And then we're going to dive into some questions that we got from a LinkedIn post where we asked people to give us their questions on psychological safety. Before we do that, I just want to give a quick introduction to yourself in case there's any weirdos out there that like to start series halfway through or at the end.
That's a good chat. Thanks. So my name's Tom Geraghty. I'm the founder of psychsafety.com. I'm basically a psychological safety geek. That's what I do for a living. I geek out about psychological safety and get other people excited about it as well. My background is in sort of originally scientific research and then technology, and through a roundabout sort of way I've landed here.
Nice. So workers done works imagine is a very kind of popular topic. But for those that don't know, it's kind of essentially a gap between the blunt end of the organization, the boardroom, the senior managers, of how we think work is done and what problems we think they're dealing with and what solutions are working or not working and so on. And then how work is done, which is the reality, right? I think when we talk about this, from my company's point of view, when we talk about this, I think everyone talks about this from the perspective of a very big organization, your BPs and your, you know, these massive organizations. which is very clear that workers don't work to imagine is going to be, it's obvious, isn't it, really, in a way? Yeah. Like, yeah. How is Mr. BP have any idea what BP in London are doing? It's not possible. The sheer scale of it kind of a given.
Yeah.
I've seen this manifest in tiny organizations as well. Really small organizations, family-run businesses where the boss is involved. He's involved. He or she is hands-on, you know, really small business, and still have no idea that something was going on or something was done in this way or that was a problem that they experienced.
I would argue, in fact, that a lot of the time, I mean, you could be an organization of one. You could be, like, just me. Like, I reckon that the way I imagine I make a cup of tea isn't actually the way I make a cup of tea.
Such a good point. Have you ever tried, I think it's the point say do thing that I think the Japanese train drivers do it, where you point it, you say, so if you were driving the car, you would point at the gear stick, you would say move to second gear, then you would move it to second gear. But you would also have to point at the clutch and say pressing the clutch all at the same time, right? If you ever do that, you really, I nearly crashed my car trying to do it once, honestly. And when you really break stuff down, it's really interesting. Yeah. We're doing a lot of work at the moment with a lot of, like, smaller businesses that are, there's a lot of conversation about RAMs. I don't know if you've heard the phrase RAMs.
Yeah.
So risk assessments, method statements, and really common in construction, trade-based and engineering-based kind of roles. And this seems to be coming under a lot more scrutiny of late, which is good. So we're doing so much work around this. I'm doing one recently, and it sent over a load of method statements, and it was like, turn up at tower, climb tower, do job, get down tower. Yeah. And I'm like, in your head, because you're a very competent person, you've been rigging and doing all this stuff for a long time, that makes total sense. And you're thinking, it's riggers that are going to read this, so they'll know what I mean, right? They know how to climb a tower. Yeah, no. Well, on the day that they're not sure, on the day that they don't know, or maybe they climb a tower in a very different way to you. And I think actually, when you start really writing down how you climb a tower, you might as well go, oh yeah, I'm not sure I do it like that. And I think that exercise of kind of having to write an instruction on process is really helpful as well. But yeah, very true. I think maybe we all suffer from workers done workers imagined in our own way.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think, you know, if you imagine, you know, sort of illustratively, if you imagine these two different things, you know, in some contexts, they're really far apart. There's almost no overlap sometimes in some contexts. And in other contexts, like me making my cup of tea, like the gap is, like the overlap is huge. There's only a tiny difference between workers imagined and workers done. But in groups, in teams, and particularly where the person who, for whatever reason, needs to accurately imagine how work is done. Maybe they're writing a policy for it, or maybe they're doing assessments for it, or maybe they're just trying to improve the way work is done, right? So maybe they're, you know, they're trying to do some efficiency work or something, or whatever it is. Maybe, you know, recruit more people, whatever it is. And somehow they've got to understand how the practitioners do the job.
Yeah.
And that's where it all gets interesting. That's where it gets challenging, right? Doesn't it? Because there's so many reasons why trying to get the practice out of someone's head and into another person's head. Fundamentally, you're never going to get like a one-for-one match. You're never going to get a complete perfect overlap between those two things, because there's always going to be differences. These people are maybe experts. This person might not be an expert. They might have done the job before, they might have done it 10 years ago, but they might have never done the job, so they might be a layperson. If a surgeon explains to me how he cuts off someone's leg, he's going to simplify things. He's going to, you know, he's not going to name every like artery and tool and things. Yeah. He can say basically
tourniquet, saw, leg off,
done. yeah. And so, like, we simplify things for lay people. We might we probably tell a different story to our colleagues who we feel safe telling one story to, maybe, and we tell a different story to our boss, because we know, you know, their motivations are slightly different. They're going to want to hear slightly different things. We might tell a different story to the health and safety inspector or the compliance person or something else. maybe, and probably not intentionally. We just know who they are and what context they're in.
Yeah.
And so,
have you seen any of Stephen Sherrock's work off the back of this? So he breaks this down a little bit more into those the four. What do you call the diagram when you have the circles overlapping and shit?
Like a kind of Venn, like a multi-Venn.
Yeah, like a multi-layered Venn. And then I don't know if you've been keeping an eye on his LinkedIn. He's doing this like quite cool little album cover.
Yeah.
And I kind of don't understand it, but I like it.
Exactly.
That's kind of where I am with this. I'm like, there's nowhere near enough information in this, but I fucking love it. Like, keep doing it.
Yeah, like I don't get it, but I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah. How much? But he's I've noticed just now as I'm saying it and I'm looking at one of them, they've all got QR codes on. So maybe there is some more information if you do on that. But he's done one for Workers Done Workers Imagine, and it's actually added more layers, I've noticed.
Yeah, so there's four things in there. So there's Workers Imagined, Workers Prescribed, Workers Disclosed, and Workers Done.
Yep.
And I love this because so yeah, in fact, let's dive into each one of those, because Workers Imagined is how we think people do the work, either how we think other people do the work or how we think we do our work. Like, it's just how we imagine it is. Workers Prescribed is like how it's written down, how it's like how it should be done, like the policy or procedure or whatever
rules
it is.
And all of that. Yeah.
How it's disclosed is the conversation we have, how we describe the work as it's done. And that's interesting. That's what I was just saying. Like, we describe it in different ways to different people in different contexts.
Yeah.
And how the work is done is how it's actually done. And that's like the one that's kind of impossible to actually describe in fullness. Yeah.
And then we've also got to one off just having I like the album thing, because I can literally just look at the one, like, takes me like 2 seconds and I'm like, and then it sparks my brain a little bit. I feel like if you didn't have the pre-work before, like if you might look at this and be like, what the fuck? But I love it. And I'm looking at it, and that was one of the first things I noticed. So on here we've got normally there's the four, and now there's nine on his new album. So on his new album, hell, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
on his album approach, whatever we want to call it. So there's one, Workers Imagined, two, Workers Prescribed, three, Workers Disclosed, four, Workers Analyzed, five, Workers Observed, six, Workers Stimulated, seven, Workers Instructed, eight, Workers Measured, and nine, Workers Judged. There's a hell of a lot more layers to it now. My response is, fucking hell, it was hard enough to explain before. Now it's like really hard. But
to be honest, I think this comes back to my old, I can never remember where I first heard this, but the old, all models are wrong and some are useful.
Yeah. I don't know who says that, but I use that all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. Because, and this is kind of like all models are workers.
Yeah, very true.
But they're all wrong because they can't be completely accurate. So in a sense, I think Stephen Sherrock's nine layers is like more accurate, like maybe it's more true. But in a sense, I kind of feel it's less useful, because we're getting to the point where I can't remember nine things. I can barely remember four. it's great. Like, it's a good, it's a more detailed model, but maybe as models become more complex and more accurate, they become maybe less useful in application.
But looking at these nine levels, I think as I read them out, I can really start now to see how the relationship with psychological safety in a hell of a lot of these layers. Whereas if we say Workers Done, Workers Imagine, I'm struggling to maybe start going, where does psychological safety sit in that? When we start to look at it as imagined, prescribed, disclosed, analyzed, observed, simulated, instructed, measured, and judged, I'm like, okay, psychological safety is fitting in nearly every single one of those layers.
Exactly. Because how are we gonna, so let's say we're interviewing someone to try and find out how the job is done, and if we're in an environment where there is a lack of psychological safety and someone's afraid that if they admit to not following the procedure, there's going to be consequences, career consequences, financial consequences, whatever.
Yeah.
Even just interpersonal consequences. you know, even just being judged and frowned upon. Like they're not going to admit that they do it a bit different.
Yeah.
To the procedure, and then how we prescribe the work is that gap is going to increase, isn't it? Like we're so that the gap between the two types of work is going to be bigger, and that's damaging. It's not only damaging our, it's damaging our way that we can improve work. We can't improve work if we can't imagine it accurately. Like we,
yeah.
In fact, any improve what you see a lot of the time, in fact, is where we disclose the work, or you know, someone discloses the work. It's imagined, it's described, it's prescribed, and then something is changed to improve the process. But what actually we're doing is improving the not real process. We're not improving how it's actually done. We're improving how it's imagined to be. But maybe that improvement in practice doesn't work. In practice, it might even make it worse, or less safe, less efficient, or even just harder to do.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone explain it like that. But that one line there, we can't improve what we can't imagine. So if we can't imagine work as it actually is done, we can't improve work as it actually is done. Like, I fucking love that. That's nice. That's really nice.
Yeah.
I think, well, if you look at the prescribed thing, like, and I'm just thinking about my own experiences. If prescription is me telling somebody how I want to, I'm prescribing how the job is done. So I might be like doing that verbally as an example. In this one, I'm prescribing to you, Tom, how I want you to do the work. And I'm your boss. Hierarchically, I'm your boss.
Yeah.
But you're a really dominant character, and I'm actually a little bit scared of you. You're 7 foot tall, built like a brick shit house, and you do more time in your spare time.
That's
me. People listening and not watched any of this have got such a weird picture of you now. And I mean, you've had a couple of run-ins, and you've won that those run-ins a few times. And maybe to add more complexity, you're also really good friends with my boss.
Yeah.
You're now a very, very intimidating character, and it's my job to tell you how to do your job.
Yeah.
I've got to prescribe to you how to do your job. I guarantee how I prescribe it to you versus how I prescribe it to Steve over here, who me and Steve get on like a house on fire. Steve's going to get much more detail than you are.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. Because I don't want to talk to you. I'm scared of you. You don't want to talk to me. You're probably going to challenge me as soon as I say something. So I'm going to be like, all right, Tom, can you just go and do that job over there, please? Thank you very much. Bye. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, exactly. And in that scenario as well, you know, the person being told how to do the job is probably just hunting for errors, for mistakes, for, well, that's not actually, that doesn't work like that. Like, trying to, you know, looking out for mistakes that the boss made so you can point them out.
And
that sort of dynamic is just, it's destined for failure. It's destined for incidents, it's destined for disaster, because something is going to go wrong. But the converse of that also applies, right? Because so I was having this conversation with someone just a couple of days ago, in fact, in relation to IT policies, so like IT and technical policies, right? And then so we were talking about someone else who had a whole bunch of work to do to create a whole huge set of policies for an organization, create like organization needs to comply with all this stuff. We need a load of policies to in order to comply with it. So bring someone in who knows the regulations, the legislation, all this sort of stuff, or, you know, good practice, ITIL and cyber essentials and ISO and everything else. Write the policies for us. Okay, right, well, that's going to take a certain amount of time. And also, and I was saying, they're going to need to spend weeks on discovery and finding out how the process actually works. How do people actually do these jobs? How are backups run and all this stuff? Someone else is saying, no. You know, you just need to look at the regulation and like the rules and the laws, then write the policies, and then the people will just have to do the job according to that.
Mm.
I thought, this is really interesting. This is where...
If only it was that simple.
Oh, yeah. But this, and this is where we have a real... And I think this is kind of old view, new view kind of stuff. Like are we setting the rules first and saying, you've got to abide by the rules? Or are we looking at how the work is actually done and then highlighting any, you know, deltas or differences, you know, between how it should be done and how it's done in practice, and then thinking, okay, well, maybe it's done it. Yeah, it probably is done in practice for a good reason, for a bloody good reason. In fact, a lot of the time in technology, it's done in practice this way because the policies and rules were written 20 years ago when technology was completely different. Now we're in the cloud, and you know, people don't have backup tapes anymore. And so if the policy says backup tapes need to be kept on a different site for 41 days, well, we don't have backup tapes. I don't know what to do.
I mean, that's really interesting, actually, because my initial response was like, it depends on the rule. So I think my head went straight to like UK legislation. Excuse me. UK legislation for safety. I don't know anything about IT. Turn it off and turn it back on again, see if that works. So it's pretty much my extent. But my initial was my mind went to like safety legislation. I was like, okay, could we do that? Blah blah blah. And our rules are like really broad and vague, and goal based is the technical term. So you couldn't go up to the worker and say, do that as reasonably and practicably as you deem possible. Like, you just couldn't do it, could you? Right?
No.
So, okay. So I was like, health and safety at work, not a good example. Noise at work regs, good example. Quite clear and prescriptive. This level, do this. This level, do this. Quite clear and prescriptive. Doesn't work in the arts industry. Does not work in the arts industry. We had Dominique on the podcast. I talk about this a lot, but had Dominique on the podcast like 2-3 years ago, talking about her experiences with a case with the Royal College of Arts or whatever they were, I can't remember, the Royal Opera House. Mm-hmm. And basically they summarized, they concluded that regulations are not fit for purpose because they were written based on factories and industry, not for art. And the predominant part of our economy now in England, in the UK, is what? Performing arts, probably, music industry. Not factories, boot and shoe, steel, all kind of gone.
Yeah, well, and this is really interesting because this is where I learned a lot of, this is where I cut a lot of my teeth on this sort of subject, because I used to run technology at the Nottingham Arena. So it's like a 10-12,000 seat stadium, ice rinks and retail shops and everything else. But we, you know, we'd be putting on gigs through gig season. It'd be gig every night, and we'd have bands like Rammstein with, you know, and like pyrotechnics and just insane levels of noise. And yeah, that's like, and we'd be, you know, we'd have earplugs and ear defenders and stuff, because we're doing it night after night. One thing to go to a gig on one night and wake up with ringing ears the next day, but if you're doing it every night, you're going to be in trouble quite soon. But of course, yeah, of course, that sort of, in terms of like health and safety at work, noise regs, that's it's not compliant.
I'm going to work. I feel obliged here to tell a little story, to shout out to a local gig venue, because now, I didn't know this, but now it's a legal obligation apparently for bars and venues and anywhere that plays live music to have hearing protection behind the bar. Never knew that. I don't know what regulation that's gone in, because if it's in the safety regs, I missed it. but I didn't know. But my brother-in-law, my wife's family, all musicians, a lot of them. Yeah. My brother-in-law does loads of this stuff for his work. We went and watched a gig together, me, my wife, father-in-law, and brother-in-law. And I was like, oh, shit, I forgot my fucking hearing protection. I'm hard of hearing already, so I've got two hearing aids on at the moment. I'm proper deaf. These are new, these ones, and I've only just realised how fucking deaf I am. When I put these new ones on, I used to only wear one, I've got two now. I put them on, this was only yesterday, and I was like, why is everything so loud? I was like, oh, my God. Like, I've got an envelope, like a brown paper envelope, and I'm like crumpling it up, and like, oh my God, it's so loud. Oh my God. That's how deaf I am. So when I go to a gig, I take it quite serious now. Ironically, when I was a kid, I didn't. But I'm like, I will always take my hearing protection with me, and I just put them in.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, I didn't bring any. We're fucking watching an AC/DC tribute or something, I think. So I'm like, this is going to be loud. And Theo, my brother-in-law, was like, they have some behind the bar. So I went to the bar and said, got any hearing protection? And the guy was like, one second, I'll have a look. I'm not sure we do though. Went up, sorry, mate, we haven't got any. I was like, okay, no worries, whatever. Theo was a bit like, oh, it's against the law. And I was like, do my job for a couple of years and you'll realize the law don't mean shit, mate. But fair enough. 5 minutes later, the same barman that served me came over and brought me some. So he'd gone and found them, some, come and found me in a packed venue and gave them to me. And I just, as you were talking about working and we were talking about gigs and stuff, I thought, do you know what? I don't know who that lad is, young lad. I don't know who he is, but he deserves a shout out. Like, well played, mate. Well played.
Yeah, that is cool.
But, anyway, completely at peace. That was. We're not here to talk about a noise at work, Rex.
But I think, and I think this is where it's. I find this whole idea really interesting because we're kind of talking. In one sense, we're talking about edge cases, like when we, particularly at a policy level. When we talk about work, we imagine there's a certain type of work, a certain type of workplace we imagine. We imagine offices, factories, maybe hospitals, schools, you know, the sort of standard cut and paste almost like workplaces. But actually that's, you know, the standard cut and paste workplaces are probably like 1 or 2% of the actual places that people actually spend most of their working lives.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of the I'm trying to remember the Toyota production system principle of getting as close to the work as possible to sort of analyze work. Is it Genchi Genbetsu? I'm gonna say that wrong.
Not a clue, mate.
Someone in the comments will correct me on that, I'm sure.
Tom, it's actually Genchi Betsushi. All right, mate.
I think it's Genchi Genbetsu or something like that. But
okay,
it's basically like getting as close to the work as possible to learn the most about work. You can only learn about work by getting as close to it as possible. So the best way of doing it is by doing the work.
Yeah,
the best way of learning about the work is by doing the work. Second best way is observing the work and interacting with people doing the work, and then probably third best way is like asking, like after the work, asking someone to describe to you how they did the work, and then you've got sort of degrees of distance. And this was all Taiichi Ono when he was co-creating the Toyota production system. But there's an example of he himself kind of neglected to follow this principle at all times. And there's an example of when he was trying to make a production line more efficient. So he instructed some workers to operate two machines at a time. I can't remember what kind of machines they were. He instructed workers to operate two machines at a time when they were used to only working with one. But they had some slack time because they'd have to, you know, make the machine do something, wait for it to do the thing. So he perceived this slack time as kind of, well, that means you can operate two machines at once, right?
Yeah.
Actually, these machines are really complex to use. You've got to keep an eye on them in case something goes wrong. And so he didn't get close enough to the work to understand how it was actually done. And this really riled up a lot of people in the factory because they were told to do a job that was not the way it should be done in practice. And it kind of goes against the whole principle of the people closest to the work best understand how to do the work.
Yeah.
Which is part of the another one of the principles, I think, maybe the same one.
Yeah. Interesting. What? How are we doing for time? We've got some big questions. I was going to ask, I'm going to send us down a bit of a rabbit hole there, but I'm like, yeah. Is there anything else you want to cover on Workers Don't Work Imagine before we get into the questions?
Let's get into the questions. I am interested in your rabbit hole. You can't plant that seed and then
I'm not sure it's related. And we might end up going down a really big rabbit hole. There's a lot of phraseology that comes out. There's a lot of one-liners that come out of New View. There's a lot of one-liners come out of everything, right? But there's a lot of one-liners that come out of New View and Hop. One of the things that have come out of it is this, what kind of what you just said, is that there's no one that understands work better than the people doing the job.
this seems to have evolved into there's no one that understands the safety of work than the worker doing the job. I think that's a misinterpretation, and I think I've misinterpreted it myself. I think I vaguely remember me saying that as well. Like, if you want to understand the risks and hazards, go talk to a person that's exposed to those risks and hazards. And I think I have got that wrong, because I look at this now and I don't think that's right, actually, because I think they understand work. I think they understand how the work is done better than anyone else because they do it 100%. Yeah. I'm telling you now, I could stand in a workplace and fucking show you that 90% of people know 10% of the hazards that they expose themselves to. They really don't understand them. And if you were just to start to talk about the health hazards and health risks, like, no one that understands construction dust appreciates the risk of construction dust, the welding fumes. And if like you can, there's a big thing going on TikTok of like people welding really nice joints and, mm-hmm. Every single one of them, no one's wearing RPE at all. And they're just, there is not this understanding of hazards. So I think that the worker understands work.
Yeah.
Not sure they understand the risk and the hazards and safety of work.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think this is because work, like safe work is when, well, no. You don't understand, you can't perceive hazard in a sense, because hazard is the absence of a bad thing happening, right? So I mean, you can perceive, that's maybe not a great way of putting it, but let's put it like this. So I'm taking motorbike lessons at the moment, right? So I'm taking a lot of motorbike lessons because I'm not very good at it. One of the things that is drilled into you is to do checks, like safety checks, over your shoulder checks. So whenever you're doing any sort of maneuver, you're changing lanes, you're making a turn, you're coming off a roundabout, whatever, you look over your shoulder, because there might just be a car or someone else or something trying to undertake or overtake you, and that could end up in disaster. Now, you could, and actually, because of the way motorbike tests have been done, it's only fairly recent that you had to go through a lot of tests to pass. A lot of older motorcyclists pretty much just got on a bike and like barely had any lessons. So you could go your entire life just riding around, looking in the mirrors, never doing any over-the-shoulder checks, and you're absolutely fine. You're absolutely fine. If, you know, you've survived all that time. This is kind of survivorship bias, right? So
yeah,
Yes, they might know how to ride a motorbike really well, but they don't necessarily know how to do it safely because they've never had that bad thing happen to them. Frankly, if they'd had that bad thing happen to them, they might not even be here. So you've got to have someone who understands the risks to say, by the way, you should be looking over your shoulder, because one time in a million, there's going to be a car coming around there and you'll die.
Yeah.
And so
if you've never been exposed to it, you don't really understand. And that fundamentally is the issue with the health risks in a way, because you don't know it until 10 years later when you get diagnosed with cancer or whatever it is.
Exactly. It's invisible. And you don't know the risk because the risk is later on. And it might just be like a few seconds after the thing. Mm. Like if you don't look over your shoulder on a motorbike, or yeah, like you say, 10 years later when you've inhaled all the welding fumes and yeah, you get cancer or something.
Mm. And interesting, psychological safety plays such a big part in that, because that requires somebody to be able to bring awareness of that problem, and it be a positive interaction. So I really struggle with this concept of like, don't walk by, stop people if they're doing stuff, because and this is quite a bit controversial. I'm not sure that I know there's a lot of people that don't agree with me. Unless you have a good presence of good psychological safety, like a nice culture within your organization where people are used to being challenged and comfortable being challenged, it never, ever results in a positive interaction, ever. You know, lads, while you're working on that ladder, it's not tied off, no one's footing it, and you're completely unprotected. What, you need to get off that ladder, please. Come down, get off the ladder. What the fuck are you supposed to, what am I supposed to do? I'm going, right, that's normally how it goes.
Yeah.
And I just think,
I don't know many workplaces that have a good presence of psychological safety that enables you to go up and stop people doing work and say, did you know? Because it's a really hard thing to do.
It's a really hard thing to do. And it, yeah, yeah, like exactly like that. And it requires, so it requires a certain degree of pre-existing, like the foundation of pre-existing behaviors and cultures and expectations to almost explicitly, to even agree that this is how we're going to interact. I like consent. If I'm up a ladder, I consent. I want you to point out if you spot me doing something dangerous. I want you to do that. I encourage you to do that. And for the people who are doing that, for the people who are pointing it out, oh, you haven't tied the ladder off. The way you do that, like the way you do that is, oh, did you, you know, maybe the way you do that is, oh, did you know that's not tied off? By the way, Bob, you know, if you go up and say, Bob, what the fuck do you think you're doing? The ladder's not tied off, you idiot. Well, you know, you've conveyed the same information, right?
Yeah. You've started and you've invited a negative. It's kind of with a negative tone, isn't it? Yeah, but even when I find people that are pretty good at approaching it, hi guys, can I borrow you for a second? Do you mind just coming down the ladder? Immediately it's bad. Like I could lick the tension in the air. Like I could just feel it. Sometimes it depends on the situation. Sometimes I say, don't get me wrong, I'm not, if I think someone's going to really fucking hurt themselves and really die, I'm going to stop it regardless of that. But what I'm saying as an approach within your organization, like things like don't walk by, I just don't think it encourages the right environment unless you're going to put the years of work in up front that makes people comfortable to be challenged.
Yeah.
Additionally, let's say tying off a ladder, right? You're the manager that's resourcing that environment and you say, come down for a ladder. And they say, I say to you, it's not been tied off. And you say, well, yeah, that's because you cut our budget on ropes and chains and hooks and we're not allowed, we haven't got enough rope or whatever to tie it off. As long as I'm also comfortable to receive that feedback, which most of the time we're not. So what normally happens is, it's all focus on that person's behavior. There is no consideration to the wider context. And it just becomes another vote towards a toxic blame culture environment where the employee is just, it's their fault, their bad behavior the time.
And
I just don't think it helps whatsoever.
No, exactly. It comes back to a blame culture and then sort of, I was going to say individual responsibility, but that's going to come off wrong because we do have individual responsibility, but we also have to recognize that we exist in systems. We exist in socio-technical systems and systems of work and everything else that we are in charge. Yeah. We have agency, but we're restricted and influenced by everything going on around us. Mm. One of the things you said just there was really interesting because it reminded me. So I also do a bit of bouldering and climbing, and there's a climbing center near me. And a few years back, I remember I was having a go at one of my first goes at lead climbing. The lead climbing, I don't know if you've ever had a go at it, but so you're climbing up. So there's safety. There's hooks like carabiners fixed to the wall, right, all the way up. But you climb up with your own ropes. So as you climb up, you're then clipping into the carabiner as you go up. So at one point you might be a few feet above the safety.
Yeah.
And at one point you might just be about, you know, you might be just at the safety at the next one.
Yeah.
But like your most dangerous point is when you're clipping on to the next one, because that just before you do that, your safety point is as far below you as you can get. So if you fall, you're going to fall that much and that much again before the rope gets tight.
Yeah.
That's scary. It's really scary. But and I'd made a mistake. So I'd got up to one point and then looked down, grabbed the rope, but accidentally got the wrong bit of, like the down bit of rope, hooked down to the carabiner, which meant that basically I'd have like an extra double section before it got tight. And someone, just a complete stranger, spotted what I'd done and shouted at me, like shouted in a firm but not assholey way, that what I'd done, and like, stop, you know, unlatch that, put that back on, refix your safety. Because they'd spotted, but because the in, and what was really interesting, and my point is that that climbing center, the vibe there, the culture there was very inclusive, was very friendly and kind of collaborative and stuff. Like you wouldn't know most of the people there, but everyone would always help each other out because the culture was set like that. It was explicitly set like that, and I think that's really powerful. We don't have to know people necessarily. Like, it helps, but we don't have to know people in order to have that sort of culture. It can be.
How did you react, Tom? Sorry, I interrupted you there. But how did you react, and how did you feel in that instant where someone had gone stop, and you realize it's you at the top of this? That there must have been some interpersonal feelings there.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, like I felt like, first of all, I felt stupid, but you know, on reflection later on, I was like, I'm a beginner, like I'm still practicing. I don't know what I'm doing. My B layer was also a beginner. Like, we were practicing together, so we were trying to do everything safe, right? We had a B layer, you know, we were doing everything safe, but this is the thing. Like, the people closest to the work don't necessarily know that. So I felt stupid straight away, but I also felt scared, because until I refixed it, I was at risk.
Like, you're fucked.
But I was incredibly grateful, because if they hadn't done that, and I'd carried on climbing, and I'd got, you know, another 15 feet up, and that makes 15 feet up there, 15 feet, and then, you know, you're 3 feet above the ground before it clicks in.
I find this fascinating, because when we talk about safety in the environment of a hobby, we typically take it more serious, I think, personally. We typically take it more serious than we do when we're in work.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
I think we take more personal responsibility. So I do martial arts, right? So I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, not long. I've only been starting that, but I've done martial arts for years, but I've always wanted to do BJJ. Yeah. Those that don't know what BJJ is, it's like arm breaking, choking people out. Like, you're getting arms between your legs and you're trying to snap their arm, but you're not actually snapping your arm. There's like this unwritten rule. Don't get me wrong, it's martial arts, so you're always going to get the odd dickhead, but it's an unwritten rule. Like, none of us are here to rip each other's arms off and crush each other's throats. So there is this kind of like, it's this kind of like thing where, like, you put a, like, let's say an arm bar, right? So I've got their arm coming the wrong way round. It's upside down. So the underside of their elbow pit, in a way, is pointing upwards to the air. And I've got their hand, and then I'm going to push my hip through their elbow to try and pop their, Right. So that's like an arm bar. Yeah. Anyone that watches martial arts would be like, yeah, we all know what an arm bar is, James. And so you're trying to do that. And I remember once I had this young lad, and I got this arm bar on, and it was on. And I'm pushing it, and I'm going slow. I'm like, he's not fucking tapping. Like, what is going on? And sometimes in blokes as well, there's a bit of arrogance. Like, we want to go, oh, how fucking hard can I go? I'm not being tapped. I'm like, the second you've got me, I'm like, tap, 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 tap. I'm like, get me out. I'm done. Don't break my arm. But this young lad, I was thinking, he's young, he's male, he's surrounded by a lot of older blokes. Maybe he's trying to prove himself or whatever. And I'm going, turns out he was just super dexterous, proper flexible. And he was like, nah, I'm cool. I was like, are you all right, mate? He's like, yeah, keep going. I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yeah, I've got proper flexible arms, mate. And I'm like, and I went a little bit more, and then I was like, I'm done. I'm happy. I've got the lock, but like, I don't want to snap your arm. Like, if you think you're dexterous, that's cool. But there is this, and I've had people do that with me, where they've got me in something, and I've made a noise or something, and they stop and they go, "Are you all right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I just coughed. Sorry," or something like that. there is this unwritten rule, and we take it very seriously. I find it really interesting. If I was in work, I'm not choking people's out of work, but like if you're at work and you say to someone you haven't tied that ladder off, they don't feel that sense of respect and thanks that you described, where they go, oh yeah, thank you. I could have really hurt myself, fell off that ladder. I don't think people think that.
No.
I think people go, fucking off and so do you.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's an interesting point. And my other hobby is mountain biking. And mountain biking is obviously, so you know, you wear helmets, you wear knee pads at least, you gloves and stuff. So there's protection stuff. And it almost seems weird, like you're throwing yourself down a hill and you know you're riding around in the middle of the mountains and stuff, and you're doing something sort of inherently risky, but you're also trying to sort of mitigate that risk by wearing stuff and doing stuff. And so two things come to mind. One is that when, like, almost it's an unwritten rule, but it is an absolute rule that if you come across another mountain biker by the side of the trail who's like stopped, sitting down, maybe they're fixing the bike. You always ask, oh, you okay? Do you need anything? Is there anything I can get for you? Like, whatever. You always ask.
I do road biking in the summer. I don't do it in the winter. I'm not that kind of weirdo. And it's the same. It's the same. You got a puncher, you're sitting down the road. Even if you're just having a break because you're unfit like me, they will just slow.
Everyone always asks.
You're right, mate. And I'm always like, I'm fine, just unfit.
Exactly. And I think there's this culture, and it's just like that climbing culture. Like we never met each other. We're complete strangers, but we sort of feel safe to ask that and suggest that and ask, are you okay? Because there is this sort of social contract that we've written already, but like we haven't like written it. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. Where does this come from though? Like, and why doesn't it exist in work?
This is the interesting question, because maybe it's because we're drawn to our hobbies and we're sort of doing them voluntarily and we're sort of not doing work voluntarily.
Do you think hierarchies play a role in it as well? There's not really there is in martial arts, there's a hierarchy, but cycling is not really a hierarchy, is there? And like, I don't know, maybe there's like a social hierarchy, but like there is no...
There's a collectivism to hobbies and things like mountain biking, cycling, climbing, surfing. I know is the same, like surfers, you know, if they see someone in bother, they're straight out.
Yeah.
And most sports are the same, and any sports with any degree of danger. But yeah, I wonder if it's because it's something we enter into voluntarily. Yeah. I know we're compelled to work, but we're not compelled to work
there. Yeah.
But
there's a lot in that, isn't there? Rugby is the same. I played rugby for years, and that's exactly so. I've been in a ruck where somebody's leg folded back on themselves.
Yeah.
And we heard it snap. You've never seen a bunch of blokes move quicker. Like everyone, the poor lad was right. I tackled him and he went down, and then three of my lads went in to try and turn the ruck over. Three of their lads went in. This was like social rugby. So they're all fat people basically. And it's not a ruck at that level. It's what they call it in rugby is a ruck. It's not a ruck. It's a fucking pylon. And it was just, and I just heard it. And I was like, off, everybody up. And then everyone was like, yep, everyone was up. Like there was loads of us shouting, get away. The ref came over. We were like, fucking medic. And everyone just comes on it. Like, and then we had like three games going on that day. And like within a couple of minutes, the first team game stopped. Second team game stopped. And we had an ambulance. The whole club just switched on. Big incident. Off we go. And it very much sound, and I'm not saying a workplace wouldn't do that. I think if something goes wrong in a workplace, I do think we tend to come together. There's this sense of camaraderie, but I don't think it's there until that happens. It's not there before, in that moment where we go, like your story, if that was in the workplace, I'm not sure the person would feel. Do you know what? I'd even go so far to say, Tom, I'm not sure you would feel the same at work, and you're quite mature in this way of thinking, I think maybe we could even suffer from this. There's this weird thing that when we step into work, we become a bit of a different person.
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely a degree of that. And there's I'm wondering if there's a sort of bit of we're becoming a bit sort of parent-child like in work, because we perceive that we perceive all the policies, procedures, we perceive that there is, that, you know, our employer is there to look after us and protect us, and we shouldn't come to harm through work, and we sort of have this belief that work should be safe and work is safe. And maybe that's the difference, you know, we perceive work to be safe, and work should be safe. You know, when you're playing rugby or riding a mountain bike or going climbing, you know you're entering into an activity that is inherently risky.
Yeah, yeah. And you enter into this social contract. And I think it is a social contract. Yeah. Like you said, there is this social contract that, like, hey, look, none of us playing for England here. We're barely even playing for the town that we live in, if I'm honest. Yeah. Like, we're here to have a bit of fun, play a sport that we love, do a sport that you love, whatever, and you're going to work on Monday. Accidents happen, 100%, get it. This ain't no zero harm rugby. We are trying to hurt each other in a way. We're not trying to hurt each other, but we're trying to dominate each other.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a social contract, and interestingly, when you get, I mean, I remember playing in Bedford once, and there was this one guy that he was there to hurt people. And a few people fell, we'd had a few scraps going on. Do you know what? Both teams kind of came together and was like, you need to piss off, mate. Like, even his own team were like, you need to piss off. And because it's a social contract, like, we're not here to, I mean, coincidentally, I can speak first case of this because the guy punched me in the face and knocked me cold out. I was gone. Wow. Like, it was a little bit of my own arrogance as well, in that he was coming to smash me basically, and I stepped him and I was like, and I made a noise or I wound him up or something. So he just spun around and went bang, and I went gone. I was gone. A proper sparked out right on the chin. And yeah, he was got red card and off, and even his team were like, yeah, you need to back off, mate. So there is this social contract that we go into, this camaraderie where we're looking after each other. I just don't see it at work.
Well, yeah, and I think this is the thing, and we should get to these questions now, because I think the social contract point, and because a lot of my work, a lot of the work I do is around creating implicitly or explicitly the social contract for a team, for an organization, for whatever it is. And that is, like, coming back to psychological safety, the social contract is such a foundational element of psychological safety, because without it, we don't know what's safe to say. We don't know what's safe to do or speak up or question. We don't know where the boundaries are. So, yes, it's absolutely fundamental.
I told you we shouldn't go down a rabbit hole. We've just wasted that. Like, the, so any particular person's question you want to start on? Or if not, I'll just pick one.
You choose.
I'm keen to... I'm trying to find one if we've got one that flows really smoothly off of... I'm going to start with Victor Tyler, actually, at the bottom of my page, not for any reason. So Victor Tyler has asked, the practice of safety seems to have proven that directing / controlling an individual's behavior is exceedingly difficult. Is the same true of an individual's feelings? Behaviors are at least observable. How does one measure the efficacy of efforts to build psychological safety? Is feeling safe to speak up or report the only measure?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I'm trying to sort of get all the parts in my head in the right order. So controlling or directing an individual's behavior is exceedingly difficult. I think that language itself is quite interesting. Is the same true of an individual's feelings? Well, no, like, we definitely can't control someone else's feelings. We can influence someone's feelings. We can certainly, you know, we can even knock people out. We, you know, our behavior, what the things that we do can definitely influence how people feel.
Yeah.
But we can't necessarily control it. we might say something that we think is going to make someone happy, but in fact, it makes them sad. Behaviors are observable, yeah. How does one measure the efficacy of efforts to build psychological safety? Is feeling safe to speak up the report the only measure? So I think one of the interesting things is that we can ask people if they feel psychologically safe. We could do that. We could say, how safe do you feel to speak up, ask questions, raise concerns? Maybe we ask separate questions and gauge their response. Well, and that, like, we could do that, but part of the problem is, well, there's a couple of issues there. One is that the presence or absence of psychological safety will influence how they answer that question. So it's kind of a bit of a catch-22 almost. Another point is that doesn't tell us what to do. It doesn't tell us what's wrong or how to fix anything. It doesn't tell us anything about the context. We have to ask another question in order to know how to remedy it. Another point is that psychological safety isn't the goal. Like, we're not striving, you know, we're psychological safety is a nice thing to have, for sure. Like, we want it. Like, we want to be happy. But psychological safety in an organization or a team is not the goal. The goal of a sports team is to win the competition. The goal of a business is to make money or something like that. The goal of the health system is to save people's lives and extend people's healthy lives and stuff like that. So our goal is whatever our goal is. Psychological safety is the vehicle through which we can help mediate and affect that. So I would say, if we're trying to measure the efficacy of efforts to build psychological safety, one of the ways in which we do that is to measure our effectiveness towards the goal over a decent period of time, because there are other ways in which we can achieve that goal. Like, we can achieve a goal in the short term through fear.
Yeah.
We can punish people and create dreadful consequences if people fail to meet their sales target, for example.
Yeah.
Now, in that quarter, and this is what you see. This is why like sales teams have such high turnovers and churns and stuff like that, right? Because the short termism in that approach achieves the target in the short term, but it doesn't achieve the goal in the long term.
Mm.
Over a longer period, we need to foster effective cultures and practices. And so one of the ways that I do this is to measure, but in a qualitative way, the propensity, the capability, and the frequency of the behaviors that both foster psychological safety and are enabled through psychological safety. Things like learning from mistakes, learning, so reporting incidents, learning from incidents, the capabilities and practices that we use as a team to take an incident and go, okay, right, what can we learn from this? Better a team is at that, the better we're going to achieve our goal. And like, you can see through that practice whether psychological safety exists in the room. Now, that's not our goal, but you know, we can see that that's at work there.
I also think, because what you kind of said there, that kind of quantitative measure of the qualitative measure, sorry, of the behaviors or interactions or whatever that contribute positively to psychological safety. I will talk to customers in a similar way when we talk about culture, and I would say, like, look, everything's a trade-off, right? So if you want to be a resilient organization, that means you're less efficient, because resilient is having loads of capacity to adjust and loads of slack, and efficiency is about being lean and just enough, just in time. So you can't be both. One or the other. But there are some things in your organization that need to be resilient, and there are some things in your organization that need to be efficient. So we don't want to be a resilient or an efficient organization. We want to be fucking both, right? Yeah, yeah. So you're trying to balance the two. So the way is, you kind of would describe the things that you want as your culture. So if you want to have a psychologically safe culture, right, as an example, I'm not a massive fan of the word culture, but let's just go with it because everyone knows it.
Yeah.
Psychologically safe culture you want in your organization. Okay, fine. So let's identify the trade-off of that. And let's identify the behaviors that fit under each one of those trade-offs.
Right. So you want to have a real hierarchical command and control. So there are benefits to a hierarchical command and control approach. We're in an emergency situation. Fuck psychological safety. Tell me what to do and I will do it.
Yeah.
If we're trying to improve and evolve, then I want a democracy. I want some different opinions and stuff. So there's a balance. So listing off these, and we call them votes towards the culture you want, and the scale sometimes tips to psychological safety and sometimes tips towards fear and demand and fear and control or whatever. And it's this constant, like a temperature gauge of a nuclear plant. It's up and it's down, it's up and it's down, it's up and it's down. And so I think when I read Victor's comment, it's just like, remove the word goal would be my first thought. Just to get rid of the word goal and just have this kind of indicator of where are we at this moment. Okay, cool, where have we been over the last month? And you just imagine this kind of, like, you know, when you have like an ECG or whatever it is, and it's going like a lie detector test, kind of going like that. Like if you're only deviating a little bit and you're just bouncing where you want to be, then that's great. But if you're starting to see a load of peaks and you're coming further and further away from the line, that's how I'd like to see us measuring organizations and risk and things like psychological safety, that harder to manage. And like, I'm also not a fan of having a goal. Like, even if we're going to talk about resilience, like, yep, we're a resilient organization because we're at level 5 of the resilience ladder. Like, cool. Wait, is it going to fucking stop now?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is, so one of the things that chart that you described, the sort of wavy line chart that it maybe is trending up. So that reminds me of statistical process control, which is another kind of operational research things that I'm really geeky about. But I find that really interesting because this kind of comes into common cause and special cause and Deming's stuff. And like what we're looking for is a common cause effect through the organization that we can continue to drive increasing psychological safety. Those spikes might be special cause. They might be one-off events that damage or helps us along the way. The other, I can't remember the other point I was going to make, but it was really good.
That's cool. We're running out of time. We've got loads of questions anyway. We're not going to get through all of these at all. So I'm going to pick Carol's next. Carol McMullen has asked an interesting question. In Achieving Psychological Safety, Amy Edmondson, in her book, The Fearless Organization, discusses high-performance teams and being able to speak up at all levels and raise issues without fear. Given diversity, personal attributes such as ego, agency, ambition, different leadership styles, etc., what strategies do you think be put in place to encourage such an environment? I think this is quite similar to Bill's as well. So, because with Bill's also talking about kind of diversity. So I might just read Bill's question out as well. I know that's a lot for you, Tom, like two really big in-depth questions, but they feel quite similar for me. Bill Stettner, who I know quite well, through WhatsApp and the amazing digital world we live in, Bill has said, how can we plan for psychological safety for people that have similar backgrounds and perspectives as us and people that have completely different backgrounds and perspectives as this at the exact same time? So I think they're both kind of talking about, Bill's kind of coming as a background and perspectives. And then I think Carol's kind of coming at the same question, but from a more personal traits kind of point of view.
Yeah, and this is really interesting. This is probably some of the most interesting work to do around psychological safety and culture, because particularly now that we have teams, distributed teams, remote teams that encompass people from all over the world, right? So we've got people from different cultures, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different educational backgrounds, different abilities, neurodiversities, and perspectives and contexts. So we're all coming to this with really different ideas and sort of backgrounds and takes on stuff. Like back in the day, I say back in the day, maybe even just 10 years ago, many teams were very, not homogenous, but more similar, because you might be in the same town, you're doing the same, you've got the same skills, from school, you know. So we're now dealing with much more diversity than maybe we're used to in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
And if
very much like back in the day, you do used to have, there's a town just around down the road from me called Corby. It's a steel town. So, and everyone's Scottish. Everyone has a really thick Scottish accent. If anyone drives through Northamptonshire, you'll know Corby, right? Because like everyone kind of sounds like me, this weird little bit Cockney, little bit farmer accents, kind of what our accents like. And then all of a sudden you go to this town and it's like, hey, you're me, how you doing? And you're like, the fuck? That's a really bad accent. But you're just like, what the shit? It's this weird, it's very Scottish, but it's not quite a Scottish accent. And it's very strange. And that's because a load of Scots came down with the steel trade. They lived in that town and everything there is Stuart and Lloyd, Stuart and Lloyd's Rugby Club, Stuart and Lloyd's Football Club. And they were a steel company. And you would live in that company, you would in that town, you would work at Steel and Lloyds, you would go to the club at Steel and Lloyds, you would play rugby for Stuart and Lloyds, everything. So you were all very homogenous, like you say.
Exactly. And that homogeneity fosters a kind of almost shortcut to psychological safety. Because Amy Edmondson, Hedwig, Bresman have done, there's a lot of research on this. There's one study by Edmondson and Bresman that highlights performance and diversity and psychological safety as a mediator. And what's interesting is that diversity itself, without psychological safety, inhibits performance. Because, and you can sort of imagine how this works, right? Because we're coming from different perspectives, different languages, different capabilities, and different context, so we don't have a sort of shared language, we don't have a shared set of practices, we don't have a shared background or context, but when we put some effort in to create a culture of psychological safety where we're allowed to sort of say things that might seem a bit weird to other members of the team because it's a local colloquialism, mm-hmm. or you know, our way of the way we're used to doing things over here is like this, and the way they're used to doing things over here is like this, and so but we've got the safety to talk about that and safety to come up with shared ways of doing things. And I think that's the thing, like it's one of the most powerful things we can do in these diverse groups is to talk about that diversity, talk about our backgrounds, our contexts, our ways of working and preferences and styles and stuff. So one of the things I do quite a lot is personal user manuals and team charters. The personal user manuals, if done well, are a great way of sort of describing the way you like to work, the way you like to do things, your, you know, when you like to work, how you like to work, what you're good at, what you're trying to get better at, all this sort of stuff. How you like to communicate, how often you like to communicate, whatever it is. And everyone starts sharing these and talking about them and having conversations about them. And they're living, evolving documents. You know, they're not set in stone. And then we can use that and use that same narrative and conversation to create a team charter, which is kind of like a social contract as well as a team charter. So team charter describes our shared norms, our shared behaviors, our shared expectations. And that kind of creates this bridge across the different perspectives and cultures. Wow. It doesn't try to squash them away. It doesn't try to sort of push them down or eradicate them, but it means that we can make best use of them and work with them in shared explicit ways.
And wow, that's amazing. I think that really comes into what Carol's talking about as well there then. So would you start to be able to highlight personal, you said about communication preferences and like, when you, to find the thing that's coming to mind here, actually, when you're talking about that stuff and thinking about Carol's point on like our own personal traits, ambition, attitude, ego, you know, the DISC profiles and stuff that people do, right? That's very much what that does, right? Tells me what kind of, I'm a C because I like loud socks or whatever the stupid thing is, or I'm Simba from Lion King and all of this stuff. I find them quite fun to do, but then they just sit there and they do fuck all. And I've always thought when you see people actually use them, it's for the complete wrong thing. It's like, oh, to being a manager, you have to be this category and that category. I'm like, no, I'm not really sure that's what this is for. But I've always wondered if we utilize them as a team to go, oh, hang on a minute. I know that Tom is an A and I'm a C. Therefore, I need to approach Tom a little bit different to how I might approach someone else, and Tom needs to approach me a little bit. I can feel like that's where they could be really beneficial. And that sounds a little bit like your team charter and your team, your personal manuals.
Yeah. I have a bit of a beef with all these sort of psychometric and personality testing things, because part of it is that a lot of them are monetized and black boxy, and I don't trust anything where I can't see what the algorithm is making decisions about me and how it's making decisions.
Yeah.
So I don't really engage with that.
Main personal experience with it was used to give me less of a salary when I got a head off job. We're going to give you this. This is why we're not the top of the bracket. But after the psychometric, you need some work on being a manager. And I'm just like,
Exactly. And this is why I got pretty good at gaming those tests. And
really?
Yeah. Because it's easy, right? So, but they're nonsense, because like this is gonna wind people up in the comments, I'm sure. But
you've already pissed off shitloads of people by saying they're nonsense. I can hear them now with their pitchforks.
But why ask for loads of proxies for personality traits instead of just asking people how they like to communicate and how they like to work? Like, I can write down in a personal user manual and have a conversation with someone about, you know, I like to catch up with my manager at least once a week. I'd like to do a little report once a week, one-to-one catch up. I like to do one-to-ones outside the office environment because I want to get out of the office, maybe walking. You know, I prefer, I'm better at working in the afternoon than in the morning, all this sort of stuff. Like, that's so much more valuable than something that asks me some question that's supposed to have some correlation with some other personality type.
Yeah, yeah.
About what we
want
to do.
Do you need psychological safety first to have that conversation for me to feel comfortable, tell you how I want to communicate though?
A bit of both. It's definitely a bit of both. Like if you were in an environment where you really had like very little psychological safety, then good luck doing
anything.
But definitely good luck doing personal user manuals, effective personal user manuals. But you've got to start somewhere. This is why they're living, breathing documents, because as we have those conversations, as we share them around and we don't always know ourselves well enough to like, this is work as imagined versus work as done, kind of. This is how I imagine myself to be versus how I actually am. But so as we're writing and as we're talking about it, that's going to change and evolve, and we're going to change something and realize we're not actually like that or whatever.
It's interesting. I really like the idea of it. I really like it. I feel like it requires. Sorry, I thought my hearing aid was whistling. I feel like it's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got to be comfortable telling your boss things maybe that you're not quite good at, or that they might not agree with, or something. I don't know. Like, and when there's that feeling that like, oh, are they going to judge me because I'm not a very good communicator? And then are they going to come back to me? And this comes back to kind of what we were talking about earlier, that votes thing, is that the second you might do something like that, and if I feel comfortable tell you I'm not a very good communicator, the second you use that against me, you've now got a vote to discourage psychological safety.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's two important points there. So one is that the boss, the manager, or whoever should be doing this as well, for sure. There's actually I have a template for this, which is like a manager manual, which describes it's for a manager to describe how they will manage and do stuff and stuff like that. Another, but the probably more crucial point is that, particularly in terms of communication, I don't believe anyone is a good or bad communicator. But in the personal user manuals, we describe how how we are best at communicating. Someone over here might be best at communicating in written format. Someone else might be best at communicating in verbal. Someone else might be best at communicating in sketch notes. We all have our preferences and styles, and their strengths. You know, but once we start to articulate that, once we start to make it explicit and talk about it, we're not trying to, like, this is the whole like don't measure fish by how good they are at riding a bicycle. Like once someone tells you, my preferred way of communication is through written format, because that way I can best get my heads out on paper, my thoughts out on paper, and juggle them and put them in the right place. Well, fine, then we'll do that. Mm. But you know, so you're talking about what you're good at and what your preferences are, not necessarily what your weaknesses are. I mean, you might talk about what you're trying to get better at, and that's cool. But that's so that someone can help you improve at that. And
yeah,
a manager, someone in a position of status would do the same.
Wow, amazing. I think I've said this at the end of every episode, Tom, but I genuinely could talk to you for a millennium. I really could. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This is brilliant. Yeah. We should. I want to carry on, but we can't.
I can't. I've got a shoot, and you've got a shoot as well. Tom, if people want to learn more from you, they want to work with you, so on, what does that look like? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Best way is to direct way, just email me at tom@psychsafety.com, or you can head over to the website psychsafety.com.co.uk and dive in. There's loads of resources and the newsletter and the community and meetups and all sorts of stuff. So if you're just sort of taking tentative steps, then just head over there and see what starts to make you feel safe.
Try before you buy, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being a quarterly co-host and getting through three episodes. I think anyone that really is struggling to get their head around psychological safety, I'm hoping that they got a hell of a lot out of this. So thank you very much for that, Tom. You are a geek. You definitely are a geek. But that's good. The world needs more geeks, mate. So thank you very, very much. Been an absolute pleasure to get to know you and learn some more about psychological safety.
It's been a pleasure, mate. I really, really appreciated it, and I've really, really enjoyed it. So yeah, I genuinely really appreciate it, and it means a lot. Yeah.
Okay, peeps. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Thank you very much for being patient. Thank you very much for listening. Again, apologies for the delay. We're trying really hard to find ways to stay more consistent with the podcast, back to where we were, and get consistently putting them out on Mondays, like we have done for 5 years to date. We're just so busy at the moment. We're just absolutely rammed trying to get it out, and the podcast keeps falling foul of that, which it shouldn't, and we keep telling ourselves it shouldn't. We love doing it, but it's freaking hard work. So again, apologies. Like I said, quarterly co-host has paused, but that does not mean that you can't come on the podcast. If you want to come on the podcast, please don't feel like you have to be a speaker or an academic or a consultant, a freaking entrepreneur, rugby player, fucking celebrity, whatever. You are a celebrity in your own world, and your opinion, your perspective is really important to us. So please come on the podcast. Like, if you've got something that's just annoying you, or you did a post on LinkedIn, you want to talk about it a little bit more, you've seen a post on LinkedIn, you want to talk about it some more, something happened at work that you want to talk about it, there are ways to do it without going through the comms team and all of that stuff. But ultimately, we want to hear your perspective about working in safety, working with safety, whatever it is, risk management, culture, doesn't matter. Don't feel like you have to come on and talk about the airy-fairy kind of uber woke new view safety stuff. You know, we haven't really had a technical conversation in a long time. So if you want to come on and talk about something technical, let's do it. It's just a chat. So please drop me an email, james@riskfluentltd.com, if you want to come on the Rebranding Safety for a chat. Maybe there's a few of you that you're like, us three mates, we're always chewing the fat about safety. Remember we do this on Rebound Safety with James? Yeah, bang on. Like, come on over. Drop me a line, or you can DM me on LinkedIn. Thank you very much. Check out some of the other social media platforms as part of trying to improve Rebound Safety and get consistent with the podcast. We're also trying to increase the amount of stuff we do on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube Shorts as well. So keep your eye out there. Make sure you follow us on all of those platforms. You follow me on all of those platforms. Make sure you subscribe if you're on YouTube, and keep an eye on that stuff. And feedback, yeah? If you like the style of stuff, and we've been playing around with how we make videos, I'm trying to do it whilst I'm on the road. Tell me what you think about that. Do you like it? don't you like it? Please say you like it because it's so much easier. But otherwise, I'll catch you next week. Don't forget to check out riskfluentltd.com if you need help with any of this stuff. And check out the next episode, which will be a diary episode, hopefully. See you later. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.